speak and then
study to get donations as well, if you don't have the funds or whatever. Because I know that to my teacher Ajahn Chah would always say, just don't make a big deal about these things. We'd always remember that there was, in the time of the Buddha, the monks of Kosambi, and they were always asking the lay people for this and for that, and they were so demanding. Because it says in that particular sutra that sometimes the lay people would see cows, brown cows coming from a distance, and they thought, oh my goodness, it's the bhikkhus coming. And they would hide, and they would close their doors, and they would close all the windows. Because they were so terrified the bhikkhus were going to come after them. So always remember that story and make sure that the monks are very easy to look after. Okay, I'm going to start the Dharma discussion today, or this afternoon, because one of the people here was talking about a passage from Francis Story's book, From Rebirth, where it was stating a very interesting piece of quotation. It's saying that rebirth usually happens in all the cases which he experienced, which he investigated, of people who said they were remember their previous lives. And Francis Story and a few other people would investigate these claims of previous existences to find out if they really were existences which actually happened, or whether they were just imaginations. And he managed to find a number of cases which could not be explained any other way, but the newborn child or the young boy or young girl actually remembered a real existence. And a little footnote, he was saying there that in the number of cases which he investigated, the average period of time from the previous birth to the present birth is about a year. But he said there was a couple of very strange cases where the person remembered the past life, and that previous existence, in one case, died 3 days after the newborn child was born. In another case, where the previous life died 3 years after the new person was born. This is very, very strange indeed, because you cannot travel backwards in time. I know when I was young, we used to have a program called Doctor Who. Remember Doctor Who? Apparently still going, where you can travel back in time. But not even the Lord Buddha could do things like that. That was just fantasy. But there is one possible explanation, which is the only one I can actually bring up, other than the fact that there was some mistake there, or some error in knowing the time of death and the time of rebirth. Because I did read about one very, very strange case which happened in one of the villages in Thailand while I was staying there. And I think it might explain how such a phenomenon could happen. There was one man, a middle-aged man, who died in the village. And because it was a very poor village in the countryside, there was no proper doctor. Just the person who was like, can you something about medicine, pronounced the man dead. And they just left him there while they prepared for the funeral the following day. But a few hours later, in an adjoining village, a few kilometres away, another man died. And the first man woke up. He came out of his bed, and he was back in consciousness again. But he spoke in such a strange way, and he could not recognize his surroundings. And it turned out, after some investigation, it was actually the stream of consciousness from the fellow who died a little bit later in the adjoining village. And he got into this newly dead person in the next village, reanimated his body, and was fully healthy again. It was a very strange case, well documented. What actually happened was there was this new stream of consciousness in an old body. And would he stay in the new village, or would he go back to his old village? Perhaps he did actually look at both wives and think which one is the most attractive and stay with her. But actually, no, that's not what happened. Because his mind was most important than his body. And so he actually went back to the other village where his stream of consciousness belonged and stayed with that family. So his family knew that that was their father, their husband. He just was in a new body, that's all. It was a very strange experience. It was a stream of consciousness, a swap from one body to another body. And that is possible. It's the same phenomena which accounts for people being possessed by spirits. It's as if the body is still viable, but the stream of consciousness is left in. So it's like a vacant house. And that other stream of consciousness could, instead of taking a proper rebirth, to take rebirth in that body, which was still viable for many more years. That's the only possibility which I can say to explain what I saw in that book there, The Search and Find a Story. It's as if, that for some reason or another, that three-year-old child, in a stream of consciousness which kept it going for those 3 years, would bleed, they would actually probably die. And the new person who just died would take over that body of that young boy. Dislodge the old consciousness, or the old consciousness hadn't left the dislodge, but most likely just take place and carry on in their life. The streams of consciousness, they can take rebirth, and it's obviously usually in the fetus in the mother's womb. But in very, very, very rare cases, they can go into a body which is already mature, with a couple of years or many years old, if there's space there to dislodge the existing consciousness, or the consciousness that's left. It's a very strange and weird case, but it makes sense to me that can be done. Because remember, the body is just like a room, like a home, for the stream of consciousness to get into. And usually, because there's already a stream of consciousness there, nothing more can come in. So it's very, very, very rare that possessions can happen. But sometimes it does. Does anyone make any comment about some of those strange cases? Of someone being reborn, and they remember a life which died a couple of years after they were born. Oh, yeah. That's not so much a story of a person being remembering the past life, the previous existence which died after they were born. This was just many instances of people who can recall past lives, evidence of past life. And the story which Stalin is referring to is a favourite story which occurred in Perth. When there was two Australians, a young man and a young woman who just been married a few years ago, and they'd just given birth to their second child. And the second child, I think, was, I always get the names wrong, I should remember. Paul and Peter, I think, or something, but I forget which one was which. I think it was Paul was the younger child and Peter was the older child. The older child was maybe 3 or 4 years of age. And the youngest, Paul, I think was the older one, Paul was the youngest, was only just born, maybe a few weeks old. And one evening, just the parents told their older son, Peter, to please go and say goodbye to your brother and go to bed. This is bedtime. So the elder child, Peter, went up to his little baby brother, Paul, and said, good night, Paul. I said to babies, look, the little children would. But what they never expected was a 3 days or 1 week or 2 week old child, Paul, said to his brother Peter, good night, Peter. Now this was a newly born child. And for those of you who had babies, the babies don't usually speak. But this particular child spoke very clearly. The two parents could not believe what they had heard, and they put the magazine down they were reading, or just looked dumbstruck at the little crack where the baby had just spoken. and without any prompting, the elder son said again, "Good night, Paul." And this time with both the parents watching intently, their baby spoke a second time, "Good night, Peter." And they were so concerned about this, they came and saw us. They weren't Buddhists, but they thought that maybe Buddhists could understand these things, they're Christian children. So they came and told the story to us. And they said, "It was not imagined." They said it twice. It was a case of my baby speaking, and the interesting thing they informed me was that when the little baby Paul spoke, it did not speak like a baby speaks. It spoke with the pronunciation of an adult. And that really sort of concerned them. They were so worried they came to see the Buddhist monks. And obviously we told them that's obviously that the person is still remembering their previous life and they can still speak. And that was the first occasion where I heard evidence of baby speaking when they were born. And since that time, there are three other cases which I've heard of baby speaking when they were only 1 or 2 or 3 days old. There was another Malaysian couple who came up to me afterwards. We live in Perth, and they said, "You know, we never wanted to tell anybody because we thought that they would think we were mad." That happened to one of our children. So, in the first few days after birth, their baby spoke. There was another case which I never saw myself, but I read about in a newspaper or a magazine. And this was in the United States somewhere, in a maternity ward, that the baby came out of the mother's womb in front of the midwife and the doctor who was on duty there. In front of all the nurses there, as if the baby was brought out of the mother's womb, he looked around and said very clearly, "Oh no, not again." Now that would be a Buddhist. Someone kind of stood up. Understand the suffering of being there. "Oh no, no, not again." And you know the fourth case? Some years ago, there was a young boy who was born. He walked 7 steps and said, "I am the chief, I am the best. This is my last ride." That's not all good. And you know, as a side tip, that when I read some of those sentences as a young boy, I didn't believe them all. I said, "Well, maybe some things have been added." And I thought that was one of the things that had been added. How could a child speak when it's born? But now I've heard of those other cases where babies have spoken, and makes it much more likely that our Lord Buddha also spoke. It's possible. It has happened. So that's the other stories of rebirth. And that's, again, that sometimes people aren't want to understand that when somebody dies, what happens afterwards. And especially young children die. I even told this story in Singapore on Saturday afternoon, just before I went to the airport to take the aircraft to Colombo. And this is similar to some things, or some research, which was also done by Professor Ian Stevenson, who researched on previous lives. I'm not sure if you know about the history of Professor Ian Stevenson, but it's well worth telling you that he was just an ordinary medical student in the United States. And after graduating, he spent a few years as a GP. But he was so good at his job that he was invited back by the university to become a faculty and to teach and become a professor of medicine. He did very well, lecturing and teaching other students about medicine. But he was such a brilliant mind that never satisfied him, so he also did the extra studies in psychiatry. And soon, after qualifying as a psychiatrist, he went into practice for a few years. But then, he was so smart, so good, the University of Virginia invited him back again to be a professor of psychiatry. And teaching psychiatry for many years, obviously as a professor, you don't just teach, you do your research. And he decided on a research project, which was very controversial. And that was to research people who claim to remember their previous existences, their past lives. And as anyone knows who's worked in a university, once you have a research project, you have to get funding. You have to get some wealthy people or a corporation ready to fund your research. And it's so ironical, our life, that the corporation which he managed to convince to fund his research was the most appropriate organization you could think of to fund research into previous lives. It was a corporation, Xerox, which made its money out of photocopying. They're the ones who funded the research into reincarnation. So he was funded by Xerox Corporation. Just as you photocopy pieces of paper, so he's researching the photocopying of human existence. And he was a very great scientist, and he researched cases of rebirth so thoroughly that his research stands out above all others for its academic integrity. And for a while, he was a visiting fellow of Magdalen in Oxford, so he was highly regarded by his academic peers. But recently, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, one of my disciples in Perth, who also liked his books, who was visiting the United States, went to see the professor. And having an appointment with him, he came back to tell me, he came back with the signed copies of Professor Ian Stevenson's works for our library in Perth. And he told me that Professor Ian Stevenson thanked him for coming, and sent his best regards to myself, especially that I supported his work. But in particular, my disciple came back to tell me just how disappointed and frustrated Professor Ian Stevenson was. That his research, even though it was done so carefully, and so meticulously, that no scientist could challenge it, that still it was not accepted in the wider community. Not because his research methods were faulty, simply because of the conclusions which he arrived at, that reincarnation actually occurs. This is some of the problems with science, that sometimes it doesn't matter if the facts are there and the methods are correct, if the conclusion is not what people like to hear. They usually put those papers aside as an anomaly, and they bury it, and it's never heard of again. And that's what really frustrated Professor Ian Stevenson. Your first-class research, and very important conclusions, but no one is taking it seriously. But in particular, one of the things he would recall, I think this was the subject of the book which he wrote while at Oxford, was birthmarks. And in some societies, I'm sure it's happened in Sri Lanka, it certainly happens in Thailand, when somebody dies, especially a young child, you want to see whether it's going to come back into your family again. So one pair of disciples, a Thai couple, having just been married a couple of years, when she became pregnant with their first child, they were very, very excited. And they came to offer Dharma, they were very close disciples, they still are. And in Australia, there was the very best of health care for free. And so she had all the ultrasounds and all of the tests. It was a normal pregnancy. For the whole term, even 5 days before birth, she had an ultrasound which showed everything was going smoothly, perfectly, and she could expect a healthy baby boy. However, in the 5 days before birth, the baby, so they told me, had turned and had strangled itself on the umbilical cord. These things sometimes happen. So the baby was still born. So they're very, very disappointed. But nevertheless, and they never gave up hope. I performed the funeral service for that little boy. They even named him Charlie. what I never noticed was, what I wasn't watching, they got a ballpoint pen and they drew a line on Charlie's heel with the expectation that if Charlie tried again, maybe the next child would have such a birthmark. And sure enough, about 18 months or 2 years later, as she gave birth, this time to a girl. And that girl has got a birthmark, a line on the same heel where they drew the ballpoint pen across. So they're very convinced that Charlie never made it the first time. So he tried again, and this time actually came through. It was also quite strange that before he was a boy, and this time a girl, then there's this girl Anne. For the first few years, having known the story, I was quite intrigued that Anne was a tomboy. In all senses, she was male. She would fight other people, and she would act like a male. Now that she's, well, she must be about 13 or 14 now, now she's feminine. But for early years, she was a very, very masculine girl. So I'm convinced too that that was Charlie. He didn't quite make it the first time. He had another try, and this time he came through. So rebirth is like that, reincarnation. The stream of consciousness that tries to come into your life doesn't quite make it, but makes it next time. Can any of you remember your past lives? If ever you get into a deep meditation, there is a way of finding out your past lives. Usually you should get to at least a nirvana stage, or even better, post-jhana. Well, after you're coming out with a lot of energy and also stillness, to make a suggestion to yourself, what is my earliest memory? What is my earliest memory? I don't know where I found out that technique, but I remember doing that once. So here, as always, I have to be careful, because many people always, you know, you asked me before, you always want to know, is this monk an arahant, is he an anagami, is he a stream leader, what can he do, what he can't do. And I'm prohibited from saying because of the 8th Pajitya rule. If you don't believe me, look in the books. Pajitya number 8 says that the monk cannot announce his special abilities to any layperson. So I'm not doing this just to hide my inabilities or whatever. All I'm doing here is actually keeping the precepts. But I usually, maybe I was a lawyer in the previous life, because I can usually find a few loopholes to try and get through. And it's not really a loophole, but it serves a purpose. Because I usually tell people a recollection, not of a past life, because that would be breaking my rules, but a recollection of an early part of this life. And it serves a purpose because it shows how this whole procedure happens. It was actually the first time I tried it. And after a nice deep meditation, I just mentioned what's my earliest memory. And immediately after saying that in my mind, making that suggestion, my mind was so obedient that straight away I got a memory of an early part of my life. What happened in this case was I could smell something in my nose. It wasn't a smell in the place where I was sitting. It was a very strange smell. But I recognized it within a second, of being the smell of my baby's crown. And with that recognition, I was back in my crown as a newborn baby. Maybe 3-4 weeks old, I don't know. But the amazing part of the experience was it came very quickly. And it wasn't like a memory where you're seeing a vision in front of you. You're right inside the experience. It's very much the same as you feel now looking at me. It was a re-experiencing of an event long past. And in that experience, I could look around my crown. I could actually see the familiar objects which were there. And I could explore the scenery. It was a re-experiencing. This is just like the Buddha would say, when you can remember your past lives, you can remember it in all its details and particulars. which begins just to ask yourself, who was that person, what's their name? And you know straight away. There was the experience of an early life, which quite shocked me that you could do such things. And there's always unexpected parts of that memory. One of the unexpected parts of that memory, when I told it to a doctor later on, was that as a baby, the smell was the most prominent of my senses. I recognised my breath by its smell. I recognised all the things around me by the smell. I recognised my mother, not by what she looked like, but how she smelled. And that was my experience as a baby. Remember, in meditation as a fully grown adult. And apparently the doctor told me that that's very accurate, because the sense of smell is what develops first as a young child. And they do indeed recognise all the surroundings by smell. So when you're giving birth to a child, it's the smell which they recognise you by, not what you look like. And if you get into a memory like that, you know that from first experience. So this is actually how you can recall early life experiences. And if you ask the next question, earlier needs, then your mind being so obedient could actually bring up an early memory for you. Sometimes it might be in your mother's womb, with all those liquids around you. Earlier things, and then you might get your previous life. Having said that, I've been teaching that for quite a few years now. And I have to let you know that sometimes if you do this technique, you'll get a traumatic experience, or the experience of your death. Your previous life, which very often is not pleasant. And a few of my disciples have done that, so I don't want to do this ever again. Because they're recalling, they're right back in their neck. That's not nice. So they immediately get out of there, and they don't want to try this again, ever. So try and get around this. If that ever happens to you, and you follow this as a technique, you get into deep meditation, what's my earliest memory? To get a very unpleasant experience. All you need to do is quickly say, earlier please. We have the ability to move away from that past experience which is unpleasant and go to what happened before. So if you're still in your previous life, you're not the most unpleasant part of that previous life. Remember, what we usually recall from previous existences is the most prominent features of it. And your death is one of the most prominent features. It's the most traumatic, the one which is probably most embedded in your memory. So all you need to do is say earlier please, and then you can recall your previous lives. And that's an important thing to do. And I've been encouraging it with my students for the sole purpose that in many Western countries, especially, people are learning Buddhism, and they try and modernize Buddhism. They say this teaching of rebirth is a lot of rubbish. We don't need to believe that. Let's just believe the other part of Buddhism and jettison rebirth. And as I see it, that that is just jettisoning an important part of the Dhamma. Not only that, but you're jettisoning something which is true, which is important. And I really want to actually to recover those teachings of rebirth and make it central to Buddhism, whereas many people in the West want to throw them out. And the best way of doing that is to have many, many people remember their past lives and be able to say, this is not a belief, this is a knowledge. I've experienced my past lives, I know they're true. I know you get rebirth. And that will make the teaching of rebirth more prominent, especially in Western countries. Even more than that, perhaps the teaching of rebirth will become more popular in other religions as well. It certainly used to be part of Christianity, it's part of Islam and the Sufi tradition, it's part of the Kabbalah system of Judaism. But really I want people like Mr. Blair and Mr. Bush to believe in rebirth. If they knew they'd have to come back as a baby to live in the mess which they created, then I think they'd take much better care about that. So once people believe in rebirth, I think they become much more responsible. They see the bigger picture. It's not I'm going to get as much as I can out of this life, and once I'm gone, then other people can fix up the mess. You come back to fix up the mess. And in particular, I'm not quite sure what it's like in Sri Lanka, but in Western countries, so many resources are given to children, but no resources are given to elderly people. And sometimes the nursing homes for the elderly in the West is very under-resourced. And the government thinks, well, what's the point in investing money in the elderly? You're not going to get any return from that investment. They're never going to go to work again. They're never going to contribute to the economy. So let's do the minimum for our elderly. But what happens? Those elderly come back again as youth. And I tell people in the West, one of the reasons why they have a problem with youth, with drug culture, delinquency and violent youth in the West, all it is the elderly people getting their own back. Because you never looked after them when they were old, and now it's payback time when they were young. They're coming back again. So it's important to look after the elderly, because that's the youth of tomorrow. So investing in the elderly is investing in our country's future. What a wonderful way of looking at it. So Lord Rebirth and Reincarnation does have important changes in the way we run our countries and our systems. We look after our elderly rather than teaching them that don't deserve any resources. So reincarnation is very interesting. Anyone have any comments about that? Christianity, they talk about the soul. And in the early part of Christianity, they also said that soul got reborn again and again and again and again and again. Early Christianity believed in reincarnation. And the reason we know that is because it was one of the very influential early church fathers called Origen. It's spelled O-R-I-G-E-N, which is different than the English word. Of the origin, the beginning, Origen's name. And he was such an interesting man because he was a philosopher and a Christian. And they credit him with giving Christianity, early Christianity, a solid philosophical foundation to make it acceptable to the intellectual classes. And that gave Christianity a big boost. At the same time, he said some other things which were anathema to the Christian church, such as reincarnation. So they had to accept his teachings on reincarnation because everything else he said was so useful. And that's how we know that he taught reincarnation. But one of the most interesting parts of his life was Origen's teacher. Because he told, well, he wrote in his books who his major instructor, inspiration and teacher was. He wrote as a person called Ammonius Sacca. And no one knows who this is, Ammonius Sacca. There was no Greek or philosopher or teacher by that name. Now remember, at this time, that particular part of the world recorded everything. There were great chroniclers, and they wrote books, especially in the universities or any important person. They were well known. But no one knows who Ammonius Sacca is. But I know who he was. You know that sometimes, for example, in the Chinese tradition, when you have a person's name, for example, he says my name was Peter Benz, or Stalin Wetimuni. In Chinese, you'd always put the surname first. You'd be Wetimuni Stalin. It's very common for us to put the names the other way around. So let's try this with Ammonius Sacca. What's it come to? Sorry, you wouldn't be. That's how they would say Sakya Muni, Ammonius Sacca. So there was Origen saying his teacher was a Buddha. No wonder they couldn't find any record in the universities. And he was the one who was already birthed in Christianity. So, there's many, many interesting parts here. But in Christianity, they say a soul which goes from place to place and doesn't change. And that's the main difference there. Hinduism also says a soul. And, you know, there's not that much difference. We don't need to argue too much. So Buddhism was a little bit more refined. You see, it's not really an entity, but a process which gets reborn. That's the only difference. But if you remember your past lives, if you can recall them, it's just the same as you are now. It's a continuity of consciousness. Cutting out of your body and just going towards your new rebirth eventually. So that's what it appears like. But if you look a bit closer, you'll see it's not a soul, but just the whole process. Does that answer the question that you asked? This stuff quite scary. You're going to get reborn. Where are you going to get reborn? Even the whole idea of it. Imagine being a baby all over again and having to wear nappies. Imagine having to go to school all over again and go to see the principal, whack, 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 until you got out of that. Oh my goodness. For those of you who have retired, maybe you have not retired, you have to go to work all over again. And for those of you who think you're still romantic, you're going to go romantic all over again and have all those arguments all over again. Oh, haven't you had enough by now? All you girls, haven't you had enough of husbands? So, reincarnation is quite scary when you look at it. Going forward into the future, now there's no prospect of going into the future. All that one can say about the future is the tendency, the inclination. You can never be accurate about the future. It's to the house staff, I told a story, which I'm not quite sure how many of you know about the story of the five angels. Do you know that story? It's in one of my books. Apparently, the gambling has been banned here in Sri Lanka. But even a few years ago, the people like going to the horse racing and betting money. And horse racing is still one of the most popular forms of gambling in the world. And so what happened that one evening in Perth, also one night, a man had a dream. Not an ordinary dream, but a very vivid dream. The sort of dream when you wake up in the morning you can remember very easily. He dreamt of five angels. And every angel had five pots of gold. And they lined up to hand over this fortune to this Australian man. And after receiving the 25th pot of gold, he woke up. He was in his bedroom in Perth. He looked around the room, he could see no angels, but even worse, no pots of gold. It was only a dream. So he went to the toilet and went downstairs for breakfast. And it was very strange that that morning his wife had made him five boiled eggs and five pieces of toast. And he wondered, what's with this number five? You see five angels with five pots of gold each. And it's five pieces of toast and five eggs. When he looked at the paper, he couldn't believe his eyes. It was the 5th of May, the 5th day of the 5th month. And he thought that there must be somebody trying to tell him something. This must be an omen. So he looked in the back of the newspaper where they have the sport. He looked in the racing section. And there is a race track in Perth named after the British race course Ascot. He noticed straight away, A-S-C-O-T, for our eye of repentance. Straight away he looked in race number 5, then after him, and he could not believe what he saw. Horse number 5 in race number 5 was named 5 Angels. Now most of the hands to you, you only get these predictions, and maybe once in a lifetime, most of you haven't at all. So he never told his wife, because women don't understand these things. At lunchtime, he went to the bank and took $5,000 out to keep the lucky number 5. He went to the racetrack and he chose the 5th bookie in line to keep lucky number 5 and put $5,000 to win. Horse number 5, race number 5, 5 Angels. The lucky number 5 couldn't be wrong. And it wasn't wrong. That horse came in 5th. And the moral of that story is that sometimes we do get predictions, we don't really understand what they mean until afterwards. Which is the trouble with making predictions. Actually, another similar story, not as funny, but the people in Singapore, how would laugh with this, because this is another story. One of my disciples in Perth, he's an English man, he married a Singapore girl. Because he was in the British Army in Singapore just before independence. So they're a nice girl over there. Got married and moved to Perth. Maybe now and again he goes back to Singapore to stay with his in-laws. And, you know, he was staying with his wife's family. They were talking in Chinese. He was getting really, really bored. He just wanted to go home. And his brother saw he was not in a good mood. So they said, "We're going to the racetrack this afternoon. Do you want to come?" And he's not really a gambling man, but when you're that bored, you'd do anything to get out and listen to the ladies chat over there. So he said, okay. So he went with his two brothers-in-law to the racetrack. But in Singapore, before you go gambling, you always have to go to a lucky temple first of all. And to get some incense and shake the incense and put it in. So they went to one of the luckiest temples in Singapore. But when they got there, the place was a mess. So they all decided to clean it up first of all. That'd be an extra good luck. So they cleaned it up and they lit their incense and prayed for good luck. And they went to the race. You know what happened? They all lost. They lost a lot of money, but it didn't matter. It's a good afternoon now. But that night, the Englishman had a dream. He told me about it. He said he remembered a horse race. And he remembered the name of the horse which won when he woke up. And he looked in the Straits Times, which is a newspaper in Singapore, and there that horse was actually running that afternoon. He saw the race in his dream, he remembered the name of the horse that won, and there's a horse by that very name running that afternoon. So he rang up his brothers-in-law and said, "Look, we lost yesterday afternoon, but I don't know what horse is going to win. It's obviously, you know, that we're in good luck now. Come to the racetrack this afternoon, we can get our money back and maybe make some more." And his brothers-in-law said, "Listen, you're an Englishman, going to Chinese temple. No Chinese spirit will tell an Englishman, not tell us. We don't believe you." Then it's true. So no, they would have told us, not you. So they refused to go. So he went alone. He put a lot of money on that horse, and he did win. And he won a fortune. Well, not a big fortune, but a small fortune. Enough to pay off what he lost the night before and made quite a tiny profit. But when he rang his brothers-in-law, "Hey, you know that horse won." And his brothers-in-law, they were so upset and angry. Not at him, but at the spirits in the Chinese temples who help these English people but don't help their own. That's going too far. They were really upset, the Chinese spirits, for helping English people, not helping them. That was going too far. But that's a true story. So the thing is, with predictions in the future, you can't really know for sure. This is a big problem with predictions. or you can have this tendency. And the further in the future that goes, the more troublesome it is to be accurate. You must know Professor John Zalecki, a famous scholar, the guy. Did any of you know him personally, Professor John Zalecki? He died in his mid-40s. He wrote many books on Buddhism. One of his best friends is a professor in Perth. And he told me the story of how he died. This is what I heard anyway. The professor, Charles Zalecki, was a young man. I think he went to Katuragama. Or went to some place where there was a medium, an Indian medium. You know, just as a young man, a young student, you just go there for fun, just to see. But the medium told him, you are going to marry a girl by this and this name. He'd never met such a girl before, nor knew anyone of that family. But later on, they met, and they married. This medium predicted the name of the woman who was about to marry, and he never knew her. Now that was beyond all probability. So he had absolute faith in that medium from that time on. And he would go and visit every year. And one time, the medium told him he would die as an old man. He would have a long life. He believed that so much that when he was in his early 40s and got sick, he never went to see a doctor. Why do I need to go and see a doctor? I'm going to live to a ripe old age. And by the time he went to see a doctor, it was too late. And he died in his middle age, in his 40s. This is actually Lakshmi Jayasurya in Perth told me this story. He said because he believed in that medium, that actually killed him. He had to be told and believed that the medium said he would live a long age, he would want to see a doctor in plenty of time to cure his sickness. So be careful. Sometimes the mediums can get it right. Sometimes they say something and misunderstand it, like the five angels. Sometimes it's uncertain in which change the future by changing our karma. So be careful for people who forecast the future. So I advise my disciples in Australia, never ever trust a poor fortune teller. You can work out why. Don't trust a poor fortune teller. They can't tell their own fortune. How can they tell yours? Okay, is there any other questions? Or should we look at questions? Let's look at the questions in the box if you have any. Venerable Sir, can you please explain the 37 Bodhipakkhya dhammas and how we develop those dhammas? That's the whole of Buddhism. It will take me days and months. The Bodhipakkhya dhamma is such things as like the Eightfold Path, Seven Enlightenment Factors, the heaps of things. It's all the whole list of the essentials of the dhamma which the Buddha taught. So, with each one of these, the things like Satipatthana is in there, the four hidden karmas, the right efforts, all of the Buddhist teachings are in the Bodhipakkhya dhammas. So, instead of, actually one of the wonderful things about the Dhamma is you can approach it from any of those angles. Okay, you can either look at the Eightfold Path, that's fine, that's usually the best way for new Buddhism. Or you can look at one of the seven enlightenment factors, which both produce enlightenment and describe the enlightenment. So, those enlightenment factors, the mindfulness, investigation of the dharmas, energy, joy, happiness again coming in as essential part of the factors, tranquility, samadhi, stillness of the mind, and also upekkha. Seven enlightenment factors. So each one of these, or the four satipatthanas, each one of these things you can use as your vehicle. It's not a different vehicle, it's just looking at the whole practice from a different angle, that's all. They are complementary. It's different ways of looking at the same thing. Sometimes we're people in the West, sometimes I have to use a bit of psychology. If they say they can't do anapanasati, instead I teach them meditation on the breath instead. It's all the same, but you give it a different name. They can't do samatha, they teach them vipassana. They can't do vipassana, teach them insight. They can't do insight, teach them metta. They can't do metta, teach them anapanasati. For those of you who want to make it more interesting, in breath meditation, I've been teaching for the last few years backwards breath meditation. Backwards breath meditation, that's an innovation never heard before. You know how to do backwards breath meditation? When you watch your breath, when I say watch your breath, what do? Breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out. Backwards breath meditation is breathe out, that's then in. Breathe out, breathe in. Breathe out, breathe in. Try it. It's actually different. You think it's the same, but it's much different. So that's backwards breath meditation. If you get bored watching your breath, try backwards breath. If you can't do backwards breath meditation, then try 3 in-breaths for every out-breath. To make the meditation fun, when it's fun, this is what I learned as a school teacher. If you're actually teaching maths or science or English, you can make it enjoyable and fun. The children actually miss it. It's the same if you're doing meditation, you make it fun. And then your mind is engaging, so yeah, I want to do this. So make it a bit of a fun, and it's much easier to do. So try to make this great meditation if you like. Here we go. When I have to do deep-seated environments come to the surface and get eradicated during meditation? If it's a deep-seated one, they don't come to the surface. All they do is just the root of them gets eradicated. You know, sometimes you've got a huge tree, you just cut the roots or poison the roots, and the whole tree dies. It gets to the heart of it. I know that it's not a very good symbol, but apparently the only way to really to overcome termites. Someone was telling me this, it's not a nice thing, but it's a simile. It's actually when you have the termite tunnels, it says, don't destroy the termite tunnels. But if you just open one, they put the poison in there, and the termites take it back to their queen. And the queen eats it, and when the queen dies, all termites go die also. The whole thing is, well, when you go to the heart of it. Now this is one of the defilements. Please don't do that to termites. But if you go to the heart of it, then all the defilements unravel. So in the heart of it, there's always the illusion of the self. Or not understanding how your children do come. So if you go to the heart of the defilements, all the defilements get cut at the roots. They can't grow again. So when you're in meditation, if you get deep-seated defilements come to the surface, that means you're being a bit restless. You're not really meditating properly. Really, you should be going to the heart of the matter to see the illusion of self, or to see something, see not, see the purpose. When all the departments, they can't stand any longer. They all get destroyed in one go. However, sometimes it happens, it seems that way. When you're meditating, I usually call this the attack of the 5 hindrances all at once. They gang up on you. So people say that. They say, oh, I was having a terrible meditation. I had karma chanda, wire power, stop and talk, the restlessness of doubt, all the same time. Of course, it's impossible. That's what it feels like to people. They're just going crazy in their meditation. And usually, you're going crazy in your meditation. I tell them to use the Nalagiri strategy. Remember Nalagiri? That's right, the elephant who was given a toddy to drink and became intoxicated. and they left the elephant free, set charging in the path of the Buddha. You all know that story from Sunday school. And the elephant kept charging by. And all the people would run away, climb over the walls, climb up trees. And they all came toward the Buddha. Buddha, get away! There's a raging elephant coming on this direction. And all the other monks, they ran away. They climbed trees. All except the faithful Venerable Ananda, the Buddha's closest disciple. And it was a wonderful act of sacrifice and stupidity. Because Venerable Ananda is a very lovely monk. He's so wonderful man. He stood in front of the great master and said, "Let the elephant take me so that I can save the life of the Buddha." You know that story. And the Buddha, out of the way, Ananda, I can look after this. So he pushed Ananda out of the way to say that Ananda was doing his great act of sacrifice. Hello, Ananda. So what did the Buddha do with Narada Giri? This aging elephant and just this small one compared to the great cousin. The Lord Buddha had incredible psychic powers. Even though this is not said, if the Buddha wanted to, he could have picked up Narada Giri by the trunk, swirled him 3 times around his head, and thrown him over the Ganges. It would be easy for a Buddha to do that. But that's not what a Buddha did. He never used force. He used loving kindness. Dear Narada Giri, kind elephant, the door of my heart is open to you. No matter what you ever do, you can crush me with your feet if you wish. You can pick me out of your trunk and smash me on the ground. The door of my heart, my compassion is unconditional towards you. Whatever you wish to do, just do. Yes, and that's what it means by loving kindness. It's unconditional, not demanding anything. With that amount of loving kindness, you know what happens. Within a second, Narada Giri had stopped. He was bowing down to the Buddha, and the Buddha was just stroking his trunk. There, Narada Giri. There, Narada Giri. Now that's what you do with a mind which is like a crazy elephant. If you have an attack of all the hindrances, you say to your mind, whatever you do to me, it's fine. You can smash me around, you can stamp all over me. Crazy mind, the door of my heart is open to you. You don't fight. You don't make war with a crazy mind. You don't try and control it. You don't try and take it up, swirl it 3 times around your head, or throw it over the Ganges. That's not what you do. The Narada Giri strategy is total kindness, acceptance, embracing of your crazy mind. And if you do this within a few seconds, your mind, crazy, restless, will be bowing before you. And you can say, there, mind is alright. That's what I call the Narada Giri strategy. And it works. I'm telling this to one disciple from Singapore who was practicing at my monastery several years ago. And I told her about a disciple in Perth who had a young child. The young child was about 4 or 5 years of age. And the young girl was upset at her mummy. Her mummy told her to do something or told her she couldn't do something. And the little child said, "Mummy, I don't love you anymore. I'm leaving home." And mummy said, "Okay. Come, I'll go into your bedroom with you and help you pack." So mummy helped pack the bags of a 4 or 5 year old child. "Then before you go, darling, come into the kitchen, I'll make you some sandwiches." And so mummy made her little 4 or 5 year old some sandwiches. And there, with a bag of clothes and teddy and some sandwiches, the mother waved her off at the door. "Bye-bye, darling, have a lovely life." And of course, you know what happened? the child walked to the end of the road, and by that time, maybe 20 meters from the front door, got terribly homesick, turned around, and walked back into her waiting mother's arms. Now that was a very smart mother. She did try and fight the child and say, no, you can't leave now, don't be stupid. She actually helped pack the bag and make some challenges, waving the child off. Sometimes that's what you do with your mind as well. Go crazy, I don't want to play meditation anymore. I said, okay, bye-bye, have a nice night. It always comes back to you. Well, so is this Singapore girl. She was actually fell on the floor laughing. Because the same thing had happened to her when she was young. She was about 5 or 6 years of age, had an argument with her mummy. And said, Mummy, I don't love you anymore, you're so cool, I'm leaving. But mummy also helped her pack bags. But in Singapore, she never made any sandwiches. She gave her $20 sing to buy her own lunch. In Singapore. And all she did, she was in one of these apartment blocks. The little girl got to the bottom. And before she walked out, she pressed the button again and went upstairs. Because she missed her money. And again, the money was waiting for her. That's how to deal with a restless mind. Let it go. Let it go for a little while. It comes back again. So when you have an attack with the departments, oh, let it go. Okay, that's fine. I can be sort of crazy. It's okay with me. But don't fight it. Don't try and control it. Because if you do, you'll get even crazier. Give it loving kindness. No, that's what you want to do. Fine, man. You want to be really crazy. That's okay with me. And then it's behaved again. Now, later, I can see another Christian. Actually, quite a few. What's the best advice that Bhagavan Shah gave you on life and meditation? The best advice, again, so much advice. Here's the piece of advice. I don't know how many of you heard this one before. But I was mentioning this in my monks last year, and in a few retreats I've given recently. It's something I never understood at all until much later. Because he said this in his first year. He told me, he told everybody, he said his monastery is like a mango orchard. And he said the mango trees were planted a long time ago by the Buddha. And he said those mango trees are already mature. And there's lots and lots and lots of ripe mangoes on those trees. And you monks don't have to do anything today. You don't need to climb a tree or throw sticks up, or even shake the tree. All you need to do is to put your hand out and the mango will fall. He says that's how you become enlightened. The tree has already been, the tree of Dharma has already been planted by the Buddha. And all the fruits are just dripping off that tree. All you need to do is put your hand out and the mango falls. And I thought, that's stupid, that's crazy. Haven't you heard about my efforts? You've got to do something if you want to become enlightened, haven't you? You've got to strive and work hard. And that's not what my teacher said. You put your hand down and walk forward. And that was one of the best pieces of advice I've ever heard. We strive and struggle to get into jhanas, to get wisdom. We find, by so doing, we're going in completely opposite direction. Remember the story of the elephant, the donkey and the carrot? When we stop, the carrot comes towards us. When we are still, the mango falls. Through stillness, through letting go, through going against the stream of craving. That's how enlightenment happens. It is such a difficult thing to do. Doing that. But many people can't manage it. When you're sitting meditation, you always want to control your meditation. Why? Because there's an ego, a self in there. what controls. When its self disappears, there's nothing to do. If you can just still the mind long enough to stop shaking the bodhi tree or the mango tree here, if you can just allow the mango tree to be still long enough, then the mango will fall. If you keep your mind still long enough, insights will fall. There's a sutra in the Anguttara. It sometimes is called enlightenment is a natural process. It just shows us how the cause and effect relationship of enlightenment just happens. That things like, you know, when you're tranquil, so the mind feels happiness. You don't have to say, oh, may my mind feel happiness when it's tranquil. It's just a natural result. When the mind is happy, you enter samadhi, stillness. You don't have to think, oh, when my mind becomes still, it just happens naturally once you have the happiness sense. When the mind is still in samadhi, you don't need to think or to determine, oh, may I see things as they truly are. It happens naturally, whether you like it or not. And you see things as they truly are once you're still. When you see things as they truly are, you don't need to think or make the decision, oh, you know, may I become enlightened. It just happens naturally. This is like the natural process of enlightenment. And you do not drive it. You do not decide, I will now go on to the next step. It's a natural progress. That's what Ajahn Chah meant. When you stop shaking the tree or throwing sticks up to try and get jar or trying to get enlightenment, then you're still. Then the mango falls. That's one of the most profound things Ajahn Chah said. It took me years to understand that. One of the other profound things, this is in my book, is a nice little story about enlightenment. Throughout the last years of his life, active years, he was getting sick. And because we started looking at the sutras and the Vinaya, we noticed that in the early monasteries in the time of the Buddha, one of the buildings would be the sauna. The Swedish never invented the sauna, the Indians did. Because that was a Buddhist invention 25 centuries ago. So the first saunas were in the Buddhist monasteries, called the Jatakara, the fire room. And it was for the health of the monks. So, when we read that, we thought, wow, let's make a sauna for our teacher. And it was actually the first sauna in the whole of Thailand. Ibn Battle started in a forest monastery. So he built a sauna for him, and it was not just compassion, there's a lot of selfishness there as well, because if Ajahn Chah would come to his weekly sauna, he would also give us a talk as well. So I thought, great, this is a way that we could get our teacher to come to our temple once a week to give a Dharma talk. And it worked beautifully, because he liked his sauna, so he was supposed to be improving his health. And so, he would come once a week, and he'd give a talk. Some of the talks were okay, some were brilliant, some were not so good. But on this one occasion, he gave a rip-roaring talk, and I was just so inspired. He really hit the spot. And then sometimes, you know, I give talks, and some of them are just terrible. Some of them were okay, and sometimes you hit the spot, and wow, that was amazing. Usually the best talks happen when they're not recorded. I don't know why that happens. But anyhow. Anyway, this occasion gave a brilliant talk. And I was so inspired afterwards. And there's plenty of other monks. Usually you go and help your teacher. You know, look after his robe, you know, rinse it out, help with his towel, and his services. But on that occasion I thought, so many other monks around. I've had a lovely inspiration. Let's go meditate. So I let the other monks look after my teacher. And I went around the back of the hall, found a nice quiet place, sat down. And I did a very, very deep meditation. Which you do when you're inspired. And after I came out, I didn't know how long. But the first thought was, perhaps it's still time to look after my teacher. So I was just alone. And I went walking towards the sauna. And as I was walking on the path, I realized I was too late, because I saw Ajahn Chah coming towards me with two Thai attendants. He finished his sauna already, so I had no chance to help him. But he still had a chance to help me, because he saw me coming. In great marks, when they looked at you, they were right inside. And he saw that I just had a very, very deep meditation. Your hindrances were not there. So he decided to try and enlighten me. He looked at me with the glare that only great ones can look at you. It's holy in your mind. He looked at me and said, Brahmavatsa, why? He asked me the question for why. And straight away the answer came out of my mouth. I don't know. It's not stupid. It's only a young man. And he laughed at the stupidity of his Western monks. We gave him so much fun and joy, the stupid things we would do. For example, when I was learning Thai language, whenever we needed any requisites, it was a form monastery. We had to go and ask our teacher if we needed toothpaste or if we needed some new sandals. And this time I needed some soap. And the word for soap in Thai is sabu. I got it wrong, I said sapo. It's quite good, sabu, sapo. But sapo meant pineapple. So I went out to my teacher, and I thought I was asking for soap, but the word that came out was asking for pineapple. So I go to tell all to me with great kindness, pineapple, what do you want a pineapple for? And I said, to wash. He almost got off his chair. He started to say, these Westerners, it's got a very strange culture, that in the West people walk with pineapples. You never know, you can get that. Then you walk with your pineapple thing. So he gave our teacher great fun and enjoyment. He loved us very much. But anyway, this occasion, I said, I don't know. And he laughed. Then he looked at me again, seriously. And he said, Brahmavatsa, I'll tell you the answer. The answer to the question why. This was coming from the great one. He said, the answer to the question why is, there is nothing. There's nothing. He looked at me and said, do you understand? I said, yes. He said, there you go. There you go. Does it mean the answer to the question why? There's nothing. Anatta, sunyata. There's nothing. Do you understand? No, you don't. If you need to be an Arahant, it's a great teaching. He said, what's the answer to question one? There's nothing. Now that was a great teaching to a great master. Yes, it was, yes. But even though he was in a coma, like many people know, when you're in a coma, a lot of times it means you can't transmit information to other people. You can't talk, you can't respond. But you're certainly very aware. Because one of the tales from his time in a coma was that every now and again he stopped breathing. And on this occasion, it was actually Ajahn Dhamma, he was on duty this evening. She's going to just sit in the question. On this occasion, one of my best friends at night was on duty. And Ajahn Chah stopped breathing. And there was always about 2 or 3 months attending on the great teacher, plus a nurse, a male nurse, paid for by the King of Thailand. You know, on a duty for 8-hour shifts. When Ajahn Chah stopped breathing, the nurse got afraid. They were afraid that Ajahn Chah was going to die. I often say that they all knew that Ajahn Chah was going to die one day, but the nurse did not want Ajahn Chah to die on his shift. Quite understandable. So he wanted to try and get Ajahn Chah breathing again. The monk said, leave him alone, he's just in his deep meditation. If you read the sutras in the 4th jhana, you stop breathing. Ajahn Chah was just doing his jhanas. But the nurse said, no, we've got to revive him. The monk said, leave him alone. They had an argument, and in the end they came to a compromise, and the compromise was to take blood samples every few minutes to make sure the blood was well oxygenated. Because the nurse was just concerned, if you don't have enough oxygen in the blood, if you're not feeding, you have brain damage. That's the only purpose of oxygen in the blood, to keep everything your own doctors. Have I done that right, Stanley? Yeah. So what they did, even though he wasn't breathing for a few hours, the blood, the oxygen level in the blood was always constant. Wasn't using any oxygen. So it's enough to keep everything healthy. There was an interesting piece of research done on a meditator in jhanas, fourth jhana, or beyond. What actually happens? The oxygen is always constant in the blood, so you don't need to breathe. But the other side of that is that the Soviets at that time, without Ajahn Chah, was still entering jhanas whenever he wanted. So even though he could not communicate, he was certainly very conscious, and also still doing his meditation. You could know that by the fact his breathing was stopped for many hours. Maybe we'll do one more question and then we'll stop for the break, and then we can have to do some meditation, see if you can stop your breathing. Then it was, how does one meditate? As it against the gravitational pull of our Earth. It's a strange thing that how it actually works. If I've been a scientist before, you know that sometimes these things which you see or hear about seem to be against science, but usually it's because we don't understand the science well enough. When the Buddha described meditation, he said that sometimes it depends upon so much joy and happiness your body feels life as light as a feather. And sometimes even we do use that word in English, when you're light-hearted, it means you're joyful. So it seems to be that there is some remnant of this truth in our English language. But usually you have to be very, very, very still to be able to get those sorts of powers. And to be able to levitate. And very, very few monks manage to do that. And even if they do that, they usually keep it very quiet. Because one of the other reasons, for example, if you learn how to levitate, and you levitate here in front of everybody else, what would happen to you? Not only would you be invited to represent Sri Lanka in the next Olympic Games in Beijing, in the high jump and the pole vault, which you would win so easily, being able to levitate higher than anybody else. If you could learn how to read people's minds, the government secret service would also employ you to be able to read the minds of the Tamil Tigers or anyone else to find out what their plans really are. And then they'd probably send you to Guantanamo Bay to check out all those people there to see who are the real terrorists and where Osama bin Laden is hiding. You'd never have any peace and quiet if you could read people's minds. So the best thing is, if you keep it quiet, you can do these things, don't let anybody know. Otherwise, you'll just be the subject of research. You'll just be like a guinea pig in some laboratory while people try and find out what's going on. And it's not really what Buddhism is all about, you know, doing special tricks. Which is why, and it's a powerful teaching of the Buddha, he said the only psychic power which he recommends and praises is the power of teaching the Dhamma. That's what the Buddha said. Of all the psychic powers and magic things, all the other ones, he says, are just not worth anything. The only psychic power which he recommends is to be able to teach and impart the Dhamma to others. So that's the only psychic power which monks show. Psychic powers. Even if monks could read your mind, they wouldn't. Come on, who would want to read your mind? It's not exactly Tolstoy or Charles Dickens or Shakespeare. Okay, I think that's enough. I'll leave the other questions to the team. Hopefully your tiredness has now been dispelled. It's what the thought that is out of eating too much food is gone.
And now maybe he'll meditate.
So the entertainment session is over now. So you can now have another 4 hours, 4 to 4.5 hours of meditation, another hour and a quarter to feed night. So please make sure you use, sorry, 3 o'clock exactly. You use the time wisely. I know I'm going upstairs, and if you'd like to come up for your interviews, you can start straight away on good energy. So those of you who want interviews, you can please come up now.